Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Vertiv quarterly conference call. Now, during today's conference, all telephone participants will be in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session. Now, at that time, if you have a question, you can queue up over the phone lines by dialing 1-4, that's 1, followed by the 4 on your telephone keypad. If you need to speak to the operator at any time during the conference, you can do that by dialing star 0. Now, a quick reminder, today's conference is being recorded. It's October 25th, 2018. And it's now my pleasure to turn the call over to Barry Mandenach, Head of Distribution with Vertiv Investment Partners. Please go ahead, sir.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. This is Barry Mandenach, and I'm really pleased that you're joining us for today's CIO Insights panel. Today's panel will be moderated by our Chief Market Strategist, Joe Terranova, and will feature three Chief Investment Officers from Vertiv Investment Partners, Doug Foreman, Jim Keegan, and Nathan Partain. Doug Foreman is Chief Investment Officer at Kayne Anderson Rudnick Investment Management and is the Portfolio Manager of the Vertiv Kayne Anderson Rudnick Midcap Growth Fund. Jim Keegan is the Chief Investment Officer and Chairman of Sykes Investment Advisors. Jim serves as Senior Portfolio Manager for all of the Vertiv Sykes Investment Grade Bond Funds. Nathan Partain is President and Chief Investment Officer of Duff & Phelps Investment Management. Gentlemen, welcome and thank you for joining us today. I would now turn the call over to Joe Terranova, who's going to provide a brief overview of what took place in the markets during the third quarter before he begins with questions for our panelists. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Barry. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules and certainly a very volatile market to join the call. What excites me about this afternoon's call is the tremendous amount of experience we have from the three gentlemen who act as CIOs for their respective firms. A tremendous amount of experience is needed in volatile times like this to disseminate actual evidence and to gain an understanding of the marketplace. Ladies and gentlemen, we are experiencing right now a correction that I would argue the evidence suggests is not a portfolio correction. When you look collectively, in particular at the taxable fixed income space, those markets continue to trade in a benign capacity. Liquidity is still present, and there is still default rates at low rates, and spreads have not widened. What we are witnessing is we are seeing a specific momentum correction in the equities market. So the very companies that have driven the S&P 500 to the highs that it reached in September of 2018, just a few weeks prior, those companies are being pared back in terms of allocation from institutional investors, and we're seeing a shift away from momentum strategies. We're seeing a shift away from companies that could be viewed as not in particularly highly liquid and companies with higher leverage levels to more qualitative companies. And it's predicated on the transfer of risk, as we've talked about for the better part of the year, from the Federal Reserve back to where it belongs, to speculators. For the better part of 7 to 8 years, the Federal Reserve has acted as the world's largest hedge fund. It has assumed all market risk with its historic purchases of treasuries and other asset-backed securities. We had a nice bridge economically here in the U.S. as easy monetary policymakers begged for fiscal policy. That bridge was the blessing of technology and its significant contributions to the economy. Think to yourself for a second, economically, what technology has done for the United States. We are a software and services economy. We are no longer the GE economy. And ladies and gentlemen, if you think about technology, the second leading exporter of technology, as I often cite, is Israel. So on a competitive basis, there is no geographic region that is able to present as a catalyst to the economy and the corporate earnings sector an industry like technology. It has been disruptive here in the U.S. We saw that retail. We saw that in the energy markets. Both retail and energy have gone through a healing process in 2017 and the early part of 2018. But this technological bridge provided time for asset prices to remain at historically high levels, and we transferred an easy monetary policy walked across the technology bridge, and on came fiscal policy that has been pro-growth in the form of lifting of regulation, in the form of two numbers that are incredibly important to corporate America, that being 35 and 21. And I'm not talking about a football score. I'm talking about the corporate tax going from 35 to 21. So we have seen fiscal policy that is lifting GDP. It is exciting the economy once again, and it is motivating the Federal Reserve to transfer the risk back to speculators and investors once again where it rightfully belongs. Now, the bond bull market, which ended in July 2016, for the better part of 2 years and a month and a half, was able to digest a normalization on the part of the Federal Reserve in rates. In late August, through the better part of September, the markets began to sniff out that the Federal Reserve might act in a little bit of more of a hawkish capacity than the street was currently expecting. What we are witnessing is that recognition happened in a period where markets were absent significant liquidity. So in the conversation we have with the three gentlemen today, I want you to think about two words, and I want to make sure everyone engages in questions for these three gentlemen and myself at the end of our conversation, but I want to focus on liquidity and leverage because they're so incredibly important to your portfolios looking forward over the next couple of years. We want to make sure that we're seeking deep liquidity in all of the assets that we're owning. We want to make sure that leverage levels are at comfortable levels. We want to make sure we have low leverage. These are critical themes, ladies and gentlemen, that's important to understand. Now, I mentioned at the top, this isn't momentum equity correction. It is not a portfolio correction. None of us here today are to tell you or are going to tell you where the next 10% is for the S&P, either higher or lower. That is not the objective to today's call. The objective of today's call is to inform you, it's to educate you, and it is to motivate you to have a conversation about what your strategic plan is for 2019 and how it aligns with your goals and ultimately what the outcomes are that pertain to your particular life. These are the things that are important, and I want you, ladies and gentlemen, to understand we are talking about a collaborative portfolio that right now you can make a compelling argument for each and every asset class. Now, you could present to me the emerging markets, which clearly are underperforming the rest of the global asset classes year to date. We understand that, but there is a narrative that can be made when you look longer term, not in the near term, where emerging markets will still continue to experience high volatility. But longer term, there is a narrative that can be made. So it's about diversification because, again, the next 10% in the S&P, higher or lower, flip a coin. It's about diversification. It's about talking about a portfolio, about being better educated, and that's why I think it's incredibly important and a great opportunity to have these three gentlemen on the phone today. So let's begin. Nathan, Doug, Jim, welcome to the three of you. Thank you for joining me here today. Nathan, I'd like to begin with you, and I'd like to begin with you just basically if you would share some observations. We sit in the middle of Q3 earnings. We're all sitting looking at our screens right now and seeing that Amazon has missed, and we're wondering, okay, does that add further volatility to the marketplace? But middle of the third quarter earnings, just give us your observations as it relates to those earnings, some of the geopolitical headwinds that we presently have, and do we still have the economic tailwinds that I cited in my opening dialogue?
Thanks, Joe, and I appreciate the opportunity to be on the call today and sort of give some insights. I call from Chicago or Middle America from what we're seeing out here. With regards to the economic tailwinds that you sort of talked about in the very beginning, I agree with your assessment. It is a momentum-type equity correction. A lot of the economic data that, and when I'm saying economic, it's the U.S., I still think we're months to years away from the next recession. I know it seems like the market is infatuated at trying to look and see where that is. One of the measures, and I know this is one that out in the market everybody sort of has been trying to look at, is the Fed funds rate versus the 10-year Treasury. And at the in the September time period, right at the end or early October, we still were, before inversion, still have were positive 75 basis points. And it really don't go into a recession until you're a negative 100. So you're 175 basis points away from even being in there. And that's usually 8 months on average after you get there. So as you can see from that particular measure, still looks quite positive from the economy or what we're seeing from there. I agree with your assessment that the market is trying to look at, and I think both the U.S. and global markets are trying to assess, as I call the Federal Open Mouth Committee or the FOMC, with regards to the new leadership and exactly where they will be going with rates. I think they've sort of telegraphed through their dot plot that they see another one this year and three next year, which would still put you somewhat comfortable with the measure that I just gave you with regards to where we would be on a potential recession from that standpoint. And then to throw into that equation all the market uncertainties around, you know, you can put China trade disputes, EU, Italy, what's going on there. Just a lot of external noise continues to sort of buffer within the markets there. But looking at the third quarter numbers, and you have to remember at Duff, we focus in on utilities, infrastructure, REITs, as I call, income-producing type securities. What we have seen, and we're still early in the cycle there, within these particular sectors, no downside surprises have been either hitting their numbers or marginally improving the overall guidance there. So that is sort of reflective of, you know, continued good economic strength within service territories if you're looking at utilities, and also real estate, still a very good market for real estate. And as our REIT team will say, a lot of excess cash still sitting on the outside looking at the opportunity for additional investments there. So I still see, you know, fundamentals look strong, but like you said, the momentum equity correction continues to go. And finally, my final assessment there, somebody asked me, I didn't have it as eloquently put as what you did with regards to their, with regards to the momentum equity correction. I sort of used the analogy, this was like, if you remember the movie Forrest Gump, where Forrest started running, and he started running, and he ran for like 3 years, and you just had a crowd of people that would be running with him. Nobody knew why he was running, but he just started running, and everybody sort of joined in. And I think you sort of have a little bit of that here. Everybody decided to get out of the, as I call the momentum stocks, and not really knowing why, but they just kept selling on the way out. But, you know, from the art assessment.
Nathan, that's a great analogy. I mean, there's so many stocks that we could talk about. Just on a granular basis, when you look at the chip stocks, you know, suddenly Intel fell out of favor, and you had a company like Advanced Micro Devices, AMD, go from 18 all the way up to 32 in 5 weeks. And to your point, why? Because Forrest Gump was running. There was nothing fundamentally about the business that was going on. Forrest Gump was running, and everyone just decided to kind of follow him and run him. So thank you. I think it's a great I think that's a great observation. Jim, if I could just touch real quickly with you, all of this and listening to Nathan and obviously understanding my feelings as I presented them at the beginning of this conversation, this transfer of risk from the Federal Reserve, buyer of last resort, back to speculators and investors, we have to expect that that is going to come with a higher degree of volatility. You've called it a regime change. Can you kind of walk us through how you perceive volatility now and how you think volatility is going to look over the next year or 18 months?
Yeah, sure, Joe. Thank you. So coming into 2018, our consensus view was that there was going to be a regime change in volatility. It was going to be really driven by three factors. The first one, we knew that global central bank liquidity had peaked in 2017 and was going to be down significantly in 2018. We also knew, based on what global central banks were telling us, led by the Fed, that the balance sheet in aggregate for global central banks was going to peak sometime in fourth quarter or now, or and the first quarter of 2019. And that's, you know, critically important because that would be the first contraction in the global central bank balance sheet since 2008. So that was the first factor. The second factor was we thought that the market had misread Jerome Powell, and coming into this year, they felt that Powell was going to be a continuation of Yellen, what I call Yellen 2.0. I'll get into that in a minute. Then the third factor was the China credit impulse went negative in 2017 and has remained negative throughout 2018. So, you know, the Fed liquidity and balance sheet is pretty straightforward. Let me spend a minute on Yellen and the difference between Yellen and Powell. So we knew that Powell was not a PhD. He wasn't even an economist or an academic. He's a Wall Street lawyer. And our view was, and initially we had a similar view to the market, but then at the end of last year, as you know, the Fed releases the transcripts of their FOMC meetings with a five-year lag. So we got at the end of 2017 the transcripts from the FOMC meetings back in 2012. And that was the first year that Jay Powell was a governor on the Federal Reserve, and it was striking the way he was highly critical of quantitative easing and unconventional policy, and he was looking at it through the moral hazard risk of the Fed put, and then he was very critical of the Fed models. So that caused us to step back and really reflect on whether or not he would be Yellen 2.0, and we quickly formed the view that he would not. We, not being an academic, we also felt that he would lead the Fed more like a CEO rather than the chair of the economics department at a university, so more in the mold of Greenspan and Volcker, and that we thought that financial conditions would drive monetary policy rather than the neutral rate or Nehru, et cetera, et cetera. And because of Powell's concern about moral hazard, that financial stability would take on a more dominant role and that he would have a very different reaction function from both Bernanke and Yellen. The other thing is we started, and this has evolved throughout the course of this year, is that some of the formerly most dovish members of the FOMC, Governor Lale Brainard, Chicago President Charlie Evans, and Boston Fed President Eric Rosengren have really become hawkish, and all three of them have called for the Fed having to take rates above neutral. So when we put all that together, and then in concert with the China credit impulse, and China's been such a critical part of driving global growth since the great financial crisis, and then the emerging markets that they take along with them through their being the suppliers of commodities to China. We've seen that the current account surplus in China has gone from around 10% of GDP down to currently it's about 0.5% of GDP. So China's at an interesting point here because they're attempting to deleverage their economy at the same time that they're experiencing a growth slowdown. So we're not sure that the credit impulse, we expect it to remain negative but not go further negative. When you look at 2018, we really have had what we refer to as rolling volatility spikes. It started at the beginning of the year with the LIBOR OIS situation. You can even take it back to 2017 with the cryptocurrencies. Then we had the inverse fixed levered vol strategy unwind. Equities, you know, S&P fell 10.5%. Then we got into the weaker emerging markets, Argentina at the outset, and then followed by Turkey. Then the Italian election, and something that I don't think many were anticipating, which is that we knew there was going to be a populist government, but we didn't necessarily know that it would be a populist coalition of both the left and the right. Then we had, you know, the trade war issues, which led into this emerging market foreign exchange crisis. So when you listen to the narrative around all of these vol spikes, it's interesting to us that the narrative kind of dismisses these as being idiosyncratic or isolated in nature. But we do believe there's one common denominator behind these spikes in volatility that we've experienced this year and expect to continue to experience as central banks continue on the path of quantitative tightening. And it's really that there's been a tightening in global financial conditions. And then the question that you have to ask yourself today is, you know, are we now just experiencing these rolling volatility spikes that's now starting to hit the U.S. equity market and U.S. credit? Now, what's interesting from my perspective is, and more so on the leveraged finance side and the high yield side in particular, but if you look at every credit asset this year, so investment grade in the U.S., Europe and Asia, high yield, Europe and Asia, and then emerging market corporates, every single asset class had negative returns with the exception of the leveraged finance here in the U.S. So our view is that one of two things is going to happen. Either the rest of the world is going to converge to the U.S. equity market and the U.S. credit markets, or the volatility is going to hit the U.S. Risk markets, and we suspect our base case is that that is, in fact, what's going to transpire. And so
I would agree with that. Yeah, the volatility probably does stay with us, but you offer a distinctive point, and that seems to be where the U.S. Is both economically and in earnings capacity and in terms of asset performance significantly outperforming the rest of the world. Doug, I first of all, thank you for being patient. I'd like to bring you in and specifically on that point. You know, small caps clearly have benefited from a lot of the strong fiscal policy measures that I defined at the beginning of this call through 17 and into 2018, free cash flow generation, lifting of regulation. So, you know, Jim mentions the rest of the world and the underperformance, which I agree with. Talk a little bit about the excellence of the U.S. and what you're seeing from an economic and earnings standpoint as it relates specifically to the U.S., and then we could draw that comparison of how it's so distinctive with the rest of the world.
Okay, thanks, Joe. Well, I think the big thing, you know, break it into two pieces, the first half, the first and second quarter, what we saw was really a continuation of a solid earnings and revenue growth, really highlighted in the second quarter where, you know, revenue growth was exceptionally strong across the board for a lot of our small companies and the S&P 500, by the way. So there was, you know, until here very recently, there was absolutely almost zero blemishes, really, in corporate profitability that we could see. And it wasn't driven by just below-the-line non-operating factors like, you know, buybacks and tax rate decreases. All that obviously helped. But when you looked at the revenue and operating margin performance of U.S. companies, it was truly remarkable and really outstanding across the board. And, you know, third quarter now, what we're seeing, and I think what's causing some short-term weakness in the equity markets is, you know, what you're seeing in a lot of companies is their bottom-line numbers are still okay, But if you look at it closely in terms of revenue and operating margin, a lot of companies now, their revenues have come in a little bit short of what people expected. And there's a couple reasons for that, I think. But their operating margins have been stronger than expected, and the non-operating factors are still pretty strong. So, you know, the market is very sensitive to second derivative shifts in revenue. And I think what you've seen is this Wall Street, after the first and second quarter of extraordinary revenue growth, got their rulers out, extrapolated that into the immediate future, and now what we've seen is third quarter didn't quite measure up to that because things are slowing a little bit on the margin. The reason for that, you know, I don't know about all the central banks deleverage and all that stuff. I think the reason is pretty simple. Europe's been slowing down all year. Emerging markets started to crater in late May, and that weakness has persisted. The tariff talk, the longer it goes on, the more it actually affects business and definitely affects business psychology and businesses, you know, willingness to take risk across the board. I think the combination of all those factors have sort of conspired to shift the economy into a slightly lower gear. No big recession, no big disaster, but just a little bit slower than what it had been running at in the first and certainly the second quarter. And many of these stocks, as was pointed out earlier, have been the, you know, the stars of the world in terms of performance. So the quote momentum shakeout is really just people taking profits in stocks that have been up because all these concerns have started to mount, and you've seen some marginal weakness in the top line in some of these companies over the last at least halfway through this reporting period, and people, particularly growth stock investors, are very sensitive to that. So I think that's what's going on, at least from our point of view.
Doug, while I have you talking, speak to us about the yield curve, because that's been a concern for the markets over the last 9 months, and the concerns about it inverting, certainly flattening. Now, you've got a little bit of a steepening in the last couple of weeks, but nothing to get real excited about. Is there a message in the shape of the yield curve right now?
Yeah, I think, you know, it has been concerning to us, and we're still more concerned about an inversion than steepening. The steepening was the original excuse as to why the stock market started to decline, but in my opinion, the steepening has been pretty much irrelevant and small. So I still worry. I think the market could be worried, too, and I don't know. I'm no expert on the Fed, but the market may be worried that the Fed's going to continue with its big increase in short-term rates, despite the fact that it's clear that housing and auto have already seen some weakness, and that's been happening now for months. If you look at the publicly traded builder stocks, I think they're down 40% from January already. These things have been hammered. So, you know, housing and auto are clearly slowing, not just here, actually, globally. And so, you know, that's obviously the most interest rate sensitive part of the market. And even though the absolute rates are still very low by any historical measure, you know, there has been some bump up in rates and some tightening of liquidity for sure. And that's having an impact. And so, you know, I think people are concerned, investors are concerned. They're not concerned about runaway inflation, or they're not concerned about, you know, the yield curve being too steep. I would welcome that, actually. I think there's still concern that the Fed's going to keep pushing on the short end and ultimately, you know, invert the curve and send us into a real recession at some point.
Okay. Nathan, stay with me for a second. I'm coming to you in 1 second, but I want to go back to Jim. Jim, listening to Doug, and we've been kind of bantering this around. I was out in Wisconsin at a conference, spoke to a few CIOs, Jeff Rosenberg at BlackRock, and I had a good conversation about this. But the last couple of years, investors have been conditioned to believe, basically, the Federal Reserve has had their back. Financial market conditions are doing the tightening work for the Fed. The president has come out and challenged Chairman Powell. Jim, do you believe if we continue to see a correction in the equities market that the Fed will have the markets back as it has in the past and will stop hiking? Or is the Fed really in control here and going to look past that, look at low unemployment, look at the economic data, and just make sure that they get to the terminal rate?
Yeah, Joe. So I think the point that you raised is the appropriate one. And I think there should be a real debate right now as to who has control of monetary policy, because it's been clear that both Bernanke and Yellen delegated monetary policy to the financial markets. That was evident back in 2013 with the taper tantrum. It became more evident, in my view, in September, October of 14, when St. Louis Fed President Jim Bullard was calling for the first rate hike in January of 2015, and then the S&P 500 fell 7.4% in less than a month, and Bullard did a 180 and called for QE4. So I think, you know, what you're talking about with respect to financial conditions is extremely important, because it's my view that Powell is attempting to wrest control back of monetary policy from the financial markets. And the reason why we have been of the view that the Fed would be more aggressive was largely because financial conditions, and very simply stated, financial conditions are simply stock prices, credit spreads, the value of the dollar, and interest rates. So if you looked at financial conditions between the time that the Fed initiated its first rate hike and where global equity prices peaked at the end of January, financial conditions were 212 basis points looser than they were, despite the fact that the Fed had hiked rates five times or 125 basis points. So that's why, in our view, you know, Powell, I think, is potentially, Powell is going to be to asset inflation and asset bubbles what Paul Volcker was to inflation. And I
think that's a very powerful statement. So you see the independence. You view the chairman as being independent. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think he's absolutely independent. And, you know, what I was going to qualify my statement with is I think what Powell is attempting to do is take some air out of the risk market sales, because he, as well as anybody else, understands that, and he said it in his last speech, where he said the last two recessions were triggered by asset price frothiness. So our view is that he's really going to challenge the quote-unquote Fed put. And that's not to say that if the equity market went down 20% overnight that they wouldn't step in. But I believe to the extent that the equity market corrects, and that could be a significant correction, I would not look for the Fed to really step in. And I go back to the January-February period of this year, where the S&P dropped about 10.5%, and of all people, Jim Bullard, who's the most dovish member of the FOMC, came out and said that was the most anticipated correction in the history of the stock market. So watch financial conditions, but I do believe that Powell is attempting to take back control of monetary policy, and that the strike price of the Fed put is much lower than markets anticipate.
Great. That's great. And then, Nathan, this is exactly where I wanted to go. So what Jim is signaling, and I think what the markets have begun to pick up on, is you know, a little bit more hawkishness, a little bit of independence, but certainly a lot of stubbornness. And we have to have this conversation because investors in their playbooks and their strategies for 2019 have to think about the stubbornness. So you've got this trade irritant going on, and you know, we've got the trilateral agreement that still, you know, Congress has to get through Congress. Then from what I could tell you in speaking to Larry Kudlow, we're going to go after Europe next, and then ultimately we're going to have the conversation with the Chinese. While all that's going on, you're hearing the C-suite, you're hearing CEOs and CFOs in these earnings call talk about basically a tax that's being levied as a result of it, and that's inflationary. Combine that with Jim's observations and some of Doug's concerns as it surrounds the yield curve and the inversion potential, we possibly are dealing with an inflationary environment, or certainly one as it relates to asset classes that maybe we didn't expect a couple of years ago when we were thinking about deflation. So do you see the inflation, and I guess what's the hedge against that inflation?
Okay, Joe. We are seeing increases in inflation relative to where they were. But inflation has been low for so long that any rise, you know, if you sort of go around the world, everybody's migrating towards 2, and the question is, do you stop at 2 or do you go above 2 and start to see things spiral out of control a little bit relative to what we had back in the 70s, early 80s, where Paul Volcker had to step in. You are seeing it a little bit out there. I think you're seeing it more in the labor market. Right now, it's tough to find people, and you hear a lot of the CEOs, management's talking about getting labor and finding the right labor rates in place to attract and retain, as I call, entry-level workers, which is where they're sort of needing to tool up from the standpoint. And I've seen that in a lot of the manufacturing companies throughout the Midwest. Tough to find people in Minnesota, Illinois, down through the Southeast. And it's a very competitive market from that standpoint. So I think that's going to hurt a little bit of the margin. You're starting to hear a little bit about that from some of the CEOs and CFOs. You're also tough to hear some disruption in supply chains, from whatever was manufactured or was imported in from China. You're starting to hear a little bit about some disruption there. You also had that, a lot of that discussion was around the issues with Canada and Mexico. So I think this is some of the challenges that, as you see, going out there. But I don't see a huge spike in inflation coming down there. I do see inflationary pressures, but I don't see it so much that the Fed all of a sudden has to start going every meeting. And you know, if you recall, the last time we were in a Fed increasing cycle, which was in the 2004-2007 time period, they went 17 straight consecutive meetings of increasing rates, and I don't see us moving into that type of an environment with inflation. We have some hedges that you can look for if you're sort of domestically oriented. Real estate continues to be a nice inflationary hedge, and still, like I pointed out earlier, still a lot of money on the sidelines. In the private market, in the public market where we play at, they're trading at a discount relative to the market. So opportunity set from that standpoint. And we always talk about, rates versus rents. Rents would be rising faster than probably what rates would be rising. So opportunity that you see there if you're sort of trying to position yourself for 2019 and you thought you had some inflationary pressures coming through.
So you mentioned a little bit of an uptick in inflation the last couple of years, and largely I think it's kind of forgotten where we were with oil prices, $35, significant concerns as it relates to the high yield market in particular. But let me just ask you, a strong economy, certainly some Middle East uncertainty, the Iranian situation in November where we're going to take significant amount of barrels off the market. I would argue that what has happened with the unfortunate circumstances surrounding the Saudi reporter has probably had the Saudi Arabian government pull the card out of the deck a little bit faster than they wanted to, which was basically say, okay, we'll produce enough oil as we possibly can to assuage the administration who wants lower oil, and to comfort the oil community as it relates to Iranian barrels. But ultimately, at the end of the day, as you understand, those Iranian barrels are coming off the market. The Trump administration wants a negotiation regarding ballistic missiles with the Iranians, and it's not in their best interest to enter into the conversation. They might as well ride it out and wait for the 2020 presidential election. So combine all of those things, Nathan. Strong economy domestically, Middle East uncertainty, barrels coming off the market, speak a little bit, and a $70 price of oil, speak a little bit about North American energy and the infrastructure or lack thereof and the investment opportunity for 2019.
Well, we still, you know, and one of the areas we invest in is infrastructure, energy infrastructure. And we still think it's a secular growth structure and a growth opportunity there. If we're going to continue to have a strong economy here, energy will be an important component piece of that. And I think the Iranian situation, the Saudi situation, the Middle East situation in general sort of drives home one of the key points about needing, and we have the resources to be energy independent. What we have seen in the energy patch, and specifically where we look at the pipelines and the complexes to take, from the field to the refiners, a simplification story. It used to be very complex around MLP structures. We've seen that change in the last 6 to 12 to 18 months. You've seen them get religion on making it a clearer to understand how the corporations work. A lot of strategic rationale needing to be put in place from that standpoint. And we're seeing strong and improving cash flows. You talk about the credit stress back in the 2014, 15, 16 when oil prices dropped through the floor. A lot of these companies and got, as they call, credit religion. They understood that they had to have access to capital markets. Capital markets provide financial discipline to them. So they've been cleaning up the balance sheets, and they're quite strong as they emerge there. So I think, you know, from the standpoint of an opportunity set, it's an unloved area because of the pain investors took in the 2014 through 2016. But we think that's, as you're sort of looking at 2019, the uncertainty around the Middle East, the opportunity and energy infrastructure, energy pipelines and associated with that continues to be an attractive area where you're going to get, you know, nice upfront dividend yield coming in from it. Plus, you're seeing dividend growth with strong balance sheets.
Perfect. Jim, let me ask you, I just hearing Nathan a little bit and talk about balance sheets, you know full well 2008 consumer balance sheet recession, 2000-2001 corporate balance sheet recession. I think you and I would probably agree the next recession, the way it lines up, is a governmental balance sheet recession. But we're hearing about domestically here a little bit of an uncomfortable rise in the deficit, as a byproduct of some of the spending that we're doing. How should we be thinking, looking into 2019, about these rising debt levels, both on a governmental basis, potentially we don't really see it yet on a consumer basis, but lastly would be from corporations. Are you seeing that? So just touch on debt, if you would, and the impact it might have in 19.
Yeah, so... You're right, Joe, although what I would mention there is, in addition to the government taking on a lot of debt, and a lot of that was, to your point, was the transfer from the household sector to the government sector, but corporate leverage as a percent of GDP is at a record high right now, and a lot of it was related to financial engineering of earnings per share through debt financed share buybacks. So there's been a lot of ink spilled on, in the next recession, you've got to be very careful about corporate credit. I think that's absolutely fair, because one of the things that concerns me, frankly, is the fact that in the last recession, we didn't have that cleansing process where, you know, typically a recession exposes and expunges the excesses from the prior cycle. And because the Fed stepped, you know, they went right to zero, started doing quantitative easing, kept rates at zero for 7 years, and created this insatiable demand for income, we kept a lot of zombie companies alive that normally would be going out of business. And that's one of the deflationary pressures that we see going forward. And we think that the deflationary pressures, which are structural and secular in nature, overwhelm any inflationary cyclical pressures that you get at the end of the cycle. And the BIS has actually written extensively on this zombie company issue. So I think you got to be very careful. You made the point about strong balance sheets earlier. I think that's critically important at the end of the cycle. As it relates specifically to the government, yes, the deficit is projected to go from just under $780 billion in fiscal year 18 to $1 trillion in fiscal 19, and that's got to be financed some way. So we still believe that there's a shortage of high-quality collateral globally, and that while U.S. yields may look low to us, and as a bond guy, I'm not talking my book here because there's nothing I would like more than to go to bed tonight, wake up tomorrow, and have the 10-year Treasury at 5%, but that's not going to happen. So in the global capital markets that we find ourselves in, the U.S. has such a yield advantage over any other developed bond market that we believe money goes where it's treated best, and in the global government market, it's the U.S. So we continue to see global financial capital flowing into the U.S. Treasury market.
Great. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to begin taking questions in a moment, so please prepare for that. I'd like to just ask Doug a final question, if I could. And Doug, let's kind of go back to what's really so topical, and that's this, as I've defined it, a momentum equity correction. But there certainly appears to be equity names that are performing well, holding up in this correction, then obviously others are getting punished. Share your observations on that, if you could, the types of companies that are performing well and what are the characteristics that are allowing them to perform well. And then just a little bit quickly, what you're seeing in as it relates to the companies you focus on in the small cap world, in particular for their earnings.
Well, Joe, I think that, the defensive sectors in general with low economic sensitivity are what's holding up better in this correction that we're experiencing so far. And so that'd be areas like utilities and consumer staples. And, importantly, in the equity market, those are areas that really have been sort of left for dead, especially the consumer staples. Most investors have been underweight those for years now because the fundamentals have been, very weak. And they're traditionally defensive areas in periods of weakness in the equity markets, and they really hadn't been doing that until this recent period. So, and then the areas that have been hit the most are the more offensive areas, such as technology, banks, industrials, it's anything cyclically oriented, materials, they're sort of leading on the downside. So it's just, like you said, it's a momentum reversal. It's a flip of what's happened the first three quarters of the year. And as markets have become concerned about the sustainability of earnings into 2019. So, what we're seeing is, stocks that have, that are completely unblemished in terms of fundamentals, those stocks until maybe today have not been performing. They're not going up, which is unusual. It's very usual when you miss to get punished. That's standard. There's nothing new about that. That's been going on for 30 years and continues. So, but what's different about this quarter is even when the companies that we own report that have absolutely no blemishes, either on the revenue or earnings or below the line or outlook or anything you want to point to, those stocks aren't doing well. So sentiment right now, and this will change, it always does, but sentiment right now for these types of stocks is poor. People are worried about the outlook. I don't think they're worried about, inflation and the economy booming. I think they're worried about, the economy weakening further, the U.S. even, which has been by far the strongest part of the global economy for the better part of several years. So I think they're concerned about the sustainability of that, and, time will tell whether that's legitimate or not. But that's what we see happening so far.
Well, gentlemen, you've provided some wonderful content and insight so far, but it's time to be respectful to those that have called in and allow them to engage in this conversation. So, operator, if you would join in, please, and instruct the participants on the call on how they could ask a question.
Certainly. And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register for a question, you can do so by dialing the 1 followed by the 4. That's 1-4 on your telephone keypad right now. Now, you're going to hear three tones to acknowledge your request. And please remember, if you're using a speakerphone, to lift up the handset from the receiver before entering your request. So once again, if you'd like to queue up for questions, you can do so by dialing 1 followed by the 4. That's 1-4 on your telephone keypad right now. Just a
quick reminder while we wait for our first question, that's 1-4 on your cell phone keypad, 1 followed by the 4 to queue up for questions.
And as a reminder, I remind everyone on the call, whoever asks the first question gets a tremendous amount of good karma with their portfolios in the upcoming year.
There appears to be no questions queued up over the phone lines. Quick reminder, that's 1-4 for questions or comments, 1 followed by the 4. All right, we do have a question queued up on the phone lines. Just before we get to that question, once again, that's 1-4, 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone keypad. Our question coming from the line of Harish Shivashankar. You may now proceed.
Hi. I want to question again. It sounded like to me that you feel that small caps have had to run and tech and banks will continue will not do well, and defensive sectors, utilities, and staples will do the best. Did I get that right?
Doug, why don't you take that? It sounds like that's your forte.
Yeah, no, that's not what I said. What I said was, you know, those are the areas that during this correction, during the last 3 weeks, basically since this quarter started, have held up better. And the areas that have been weak were the banks, the technology, and the industrials. That's not a forecast of what's going to happen. It's just a fact of what has happened over the last 3 weeks. You know, we're still favorably disposed towards small cap. We think we own great businesses and great companies. The market will do what the market does in the short run like it always does. Corrections happen. 10% pullbacks aren't uncommon. You know, the only key question for equity investors, I think, right now is, you know, is this a bear market, the beginning of, or is this just another correction? I do think so far this is just another correction. So I would expect that leadership will change again and surprise people. You know, so we'll see what happens. But it was just a reflection of what's actually happened, not what's going to happen that I was talking about.
Hey, and Joe, this is Nathan. Let me just add just a little color to around the utility performance and maybe sort of help you understand
please.
That. Utilities this month, the month of October, are up 4.7%. This was through yesterday's close. And the market had, you know, gone down 8.8%. So that was a tremendous outperformance. And if you kept up this performance, one of the statistics I looked at today was that this would be the best month in 18 years. And the fourth best since GICs were formed. So I don't believe they can keep up that kind of performance relative to the broader market unless, you know, you continue to have, as I call the momentum correction that Joe talked about. We have seen and continue to see, you know, people rotate into utilities as a defensive measure and sort of drive home what Doug was just saying. That's where they sort of fled to in the last couple of weeks.
Operator, any further questions?
We have no further questions queued up at the moment.
Okay. I will turn the call back over to Barry Mandadek. I want to thank Nathan, Doug, and Jim for their time and their excellent content that they provided. And ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for listening in today. Wish you health and happiness in your portfolio. And Barry Mandadek, if you'd please join the call and close it out for us.
Okay, thanks, Joe, and thanks, everybody, for joining us on today's third quarter CIO Insights panel. For additional market commentary and portfolio-specific insights, please visit our website at vertis.com. If you have any additional questions or would like further information, please don't hesitate to give us a call at 1-800-243-4361. That's 1-800-243-4361. Joe, Doug, Jim, and Nathan, thank you very much for your time today. Everybody have a great evening.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.